This episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by Ford Motor Company. Built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress, from connectivity to autonomy, AI to machine learning, Ford has one simple goal: to improve mobility for its customers. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com. The Inside Transportation Podcast is also sponsored by Fenwick & West. Fenwick & West is one of the world's first and leading law firms dedicated to technology and transportation. Learn more about how Fenwick can help companies tackle the complex legal and business issues of autonomous transportation at fenwick.com. That's fenwick.com. Hello and welcome to the Inside Transportation Podcast, a production of inside.com. This is our weekly podcast where we discuss transportation trends that you need to know about to stay ahead of the curve. My name is Johan Marino, and I'm the writer of the Inside Transportation and Inside Electric Vehicles newsletters. Usually, I am joined by my awesome co-host, Jason Calcanis, who's the Inside.com CEO, angel investor, has a very lit Twitter account. But this week, he's off writing his book. But over the past few weeks, I've been interviewing some very interesting folks in the mobility space, working on delivery and kind of researching the future of transportation, public transit, and so forth. So I'm going to be airing those today during this week's podcast. It's been a weird week. I mean, you know, last week, the Nikola Hindenburg report came out. Basically, the short seller found all of this information, all of these stories, text messages about potential fraud at Nikola, which is a hydrogen fuel cell truck startup that has been wild over the summer. It's the only way to describe it. I mean, the stock has been fluctuating wildly. There's been a lot of highs and lows, a lot of things being said by the chairman of the company about the company's progress on their hydrogen fuel cell vehicles as well as electric vehicles. And now we're learning they might not have any progress there. So super interesting to see what's going on there. And we actually just recorded a podcast with two EV industry insiders, two of my friends, Omar and K10. And that's actually in the podcast feed. So if you want to listen to that bonus podcast, it's in the feed. But without further ado, let me jump into these interviews. So first off, we're going to have a one-on-one I conducted with Mark Gorlin, the founder and CEO of a crowdsourced delivery service called Roadie. They're based out of Atlanta. Mark is going to tell us a little bit about his business and what we can expect from the future of delivery. Then I'll have Jerry Tierney, who is an associate principal at Perkins & Will. I sat down with him and spoke about the future of public transit and shared mobility. So I hope you guys enjoy those interviews. And as always, if you guys want to suggest a guest to be interviewed on this podcast, please email me, johan@inside.com, and I'll get to them. But without further ado, here's Mark, and enjoy the show. Joining me today on the Inside Transportation Podcast is Mark Gorlin, the CEO of Roadie, which is an Atlanta-based crowdsourced same-day delivery service. Mark is a serial entrepreneur. Mark has created a lot of businesses. I'll just leave it at that. He's also built other tech companies, including Pretty Good Privacy and Vertical One. And in case you guys needed a good restaurant recommendation, he loves El Torero, a Mexican food restaurant in the suburbs of Atlanta. Right, Mark?
I do. They put crack in their salsa, I swear.
Well, thanks for joining me. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit to our audience? What's your background? And tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. So I'm founder and CEO of Roadie. It's an Atlanta-based startup that we launched in 2014 as the first ever on-the-way delivery service, matching up big companies and SMBs and just you and me with stuff to send with drivers that are already heading that way. So people getting paid for doing what they're already doing. Mm-hmm. As you said, before Roadie, I started a company called Cabbage, which provides working capital to small and medium-sized businesses. And as of late, it's been providing one of the third largest PPP providers to small businesses during the during the pandemic, but Cabbage has put out more than $7 billion in capital to over 200,000 businesses, which is important. Before that, as I mean, you've sort of laid it out, Vertical One, which was sold to S1 and PGP back in the late 90s. So I guess I'm either a serial entrepreneur, or you could just say I can't keep a job.
Yes. Well, it's kind of interesting that you're talking about like on the way delivery. What does that exactly mean? What is on the way delivery?
It's crowdsourced. It's like rideshare, but it's for packages. So we tap into a network of regular folks and regular vehicles to provide local same day delivery for consumers, for small businesses and big retailers like Home Depot and Walmart and others. But it's using people that are in their car. Maybe you're on your morning commute and somebody left a laptop and you can take it, or you work near a Home Depot and somebody orders a drill and that drill is being delivered, you know, three houses over or three streets down, and you can make money going where you're going anyway.
Right. So how do you know that these drivers or those delivery drivers are going in a certain direction? Is it, you know, kind of like a carpooling service, like how carpooling is done, where you say, hey, I work at this location, I live at this location. Just tell me a little bit more about how you match drivers with these packages.
Well, it's really, we all have patterns that we go about every day. And while it has probably changed a bit since the pandemic has hit, you know, you go to work in the morning, you come back. So you get an idea of what people's patterns are. So we know where drivers are and we can push opportunities to them when gigs show up in their areas. But you have a lot of drivers that are just constantly watching the app. And when things come up, they get snapped up. It gives a lot of transparency and trust to the driver pool. It's not like we're pushing them to do more. It's simply they have to offer to do it. And with that, knowing exactly what it is, where it's coming from, where it's going, what time it needs to get there, and most importantly, what do they get paid for doing it? So they know all that before they even offer to do it. It's not like if you're driving me in an Uber, I just get in and you go where you need to go. You could sort of choose all your gigs in this regard.
Right. So tell me a little bit more about how you started this company. Where did you come up with the idea? And, you know, just run through the whole journey of starting Roadie.
Absolutely. It's a fun story. It's actually a home improvement story. I live in Atlanta. I've got a condo down in Perdido Key, Florida, down on the Gulf Coast. And what we found out was the developer that built this condo apparently did not put pans underneath the master bathroom shower, which created a huge pain in the ass because somebody's leaked into six units and everybody then was on their own to figure out like, how are you going to get this fixed? And so I decided just to pull out the shower, make it nicer, and I'm just going to put tile up. So it was tile day. It was a Thursday in February of 2014. I'm driving down to the beach. I get to Montgomery, Alabama. I get a call from Glenn, who's the tile guy. Now, Glenn is from UCLA, if you know where that is. Mm-hmm. It's not that one. It's actually the upper corner of Lower Alabama. And Glenn doesn't talk like me or you. And the call with Glenn goes like this. He's like, hey, Mark, this is Glenn. That bullnose tile done shown up broken as shit. Ain't going to be here till overnight delivery, which is on Monday. I'm like, and first of all, overnight delivery was Friday. And so I'm going to get nowhere with Glenn. So I was like, where is the tile? He said, well, I think it's in Birmingham. And that was about an hour and a half north of Montgomery where I was. So I said, fine. So I hung up, pissed off, sitting on the overpass of I-65. And I look left and I see all these cars going south. And I look right and I see all these cars going north. And I think, you know, there's bound to be somebody leaving Birmingham right now heading to Montgomery. And if I just knew who they were, surely they'd throw a box of tile in their truck. Give them $20. They're coming this way anyway. It's probably someone going all the way down to the beach and I could have be a couple Coronas in by the time they get there, which is a joke that was a lot funnier before this year happened. But then it just hit me that there's this unbelievable, untapped, almost like a natural resource in this country of all passenger drivers, 250 million of them that hit the road every day with 4 billion cubic feet of excess capacity, more vehicles than UPS, FedEx, the post office, and every courier you can slap together combined. So just ask the question, what happens if you put all that wasted space to use? Right. And that's how I came up with Roadie, which is matching up people with stuff to send with drivers that are already going in the right direction.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because the hottest selling vehicles in the U.S. are pickup trucks and SUVs, yet I never see anyone hauling anything in their pickup trucks. Most people just drive their trucks to, you know, go to the market to get groceries, stuff like that. So, I mean, it does make a lot of sense. But I guess what makes your business a little bit different than other services like Postmates and OnTrack, because I know they have, you know, kind of jumped into the same day delivery space. What kind of makes you guys different ultimately? Like, is it the cost savings to the companies you're partnering with? Is it like, you know, tell us a little bit more about the value proposition here.
Well, everybody's doing sort of different stuff among those guys. But I mean, there's a lot of flexibility that comes with a crowdsource model, and it comes in a few different ways. So, I mean, we can sort of support any distance. So it's not these tight 10-mile, you know, radiuses that you need to go into. We deliver for the airlines and often wind up going 70 miles for them. And as a piece of trivia, if you ever get your bag lost and you go to the Grand Canyon, the closest airport is Phoenix Sky Harbor, and that's a 234-mile ride. We do that too.
Wow.
also big and bulky. I mean, we've got Priuses and we've got pickup trucks in the fleet, mm-hmm. so you very easily can do both of those to handle it. A nationwide delivery footprint. Some people are just regional that you talked about. So we've got well over 150,000 drivers all around the country, and we've delivered to nearly 13,000 cities and towns and cover 90% of U.S. households. So if bigger retailers are looking for an option to get their stuff delivered, they'd like to have someone that can operate everywhere. We've got, you know, 24/7, 365 customer service. We never turn off. And the biggest thing about crowdsource is you've got all these people delivering, but you have an unbelievable opportunity to flex. So we can flex to, like, you think about Valentine's Day and how you have way more flowers going out than a normal day, you know, or the week before Thanksgiving for grocers, or in the spring for home improvement retailers. Our system can learn to flex like that. And I mean, because you've got so many more people looking at it than are actually doing the driving, that when all sorts of demand comes, that supply is there to take care of it.
Right. Yeah. And so I'm assuming the majority of your business is kind of concentrated in this enterprise space, right? You guys work directly with businesses, but it's also a bit of like a B2C business where, you know, if let's say I have something that I want to send to someone 200 miles from here, you guys would also be able to facilitate that.
Yeah, we do that as well. And you're right. I mean, the basis of all the enterprise gigs is to get deliverability everywhere, because enterprises are much more than you and me going to have a daily base load of demand, and they're going to have more locations that things go out of. So we utilize that to get deliverable everywhere. And now consumers can use it, and we're definitely focusing more on small and medium-sized businesses to give them the same, you know, the same service levels that an Amazon would have that they could compete with, because then they can have same day delivery too, but they can do it without buying trucks and getting their own service signed up. They can just use us when they need us. Right. So we're doing everything from couches to cupcakes to paint to puppy food.
Man. Yeah. So we're all in this pandemic right now. You know, some states more impacted than others. I will say that I have definitely used same day delivery services during this pandemic. I'm sure a lot of people, you know, have also used it. Have you guys seen a giant uptick in usage of your services since this started?
Yeah, volume has been off the charts. I mean, we're seeing intense demand for road use services, especially if you think industries like grocery, pharmacy, home improvement. I think it used to be a service in some cases of convenience, but now it's almost like an essential public service for a lot of these industries. And it happened almost overnight. And in the retail world, you know, there's folks that were somewhat prepared for it and those that weren't. And the ones that were prepared, you wound up expanding quickly. So in the first 5 weeks of the pandemic, we probably added over 3,000 stores to Roadie's footprint across the country. Wow. Because customers can't go to stores. You need to figure out how to bring the stores to them. But amazingly, like, our on-time delivery rate actually improves with all this demand, because the more is in the system, the more drivers come in, and it actually gets better with that flexing, which is kind of the reverse of what happens in a normal model when you have a fixed number of vehicles and a lot of things come in, and then you can only do so much with so many vehicles.
Wow. Yeah. So you've seen more drivers kind of onboard onto the Roadie system as, you know, you've gone into this pandemic. Obviously, unemployment has gone up a lot. Are people kind of doing this as a primary way to kind of make money nowadays? Do you see people just or like what's the mix? Like, what do you hear from the driver base? Is it mostly still just people that are driving around who are like, hey, I'm going to work, or I'm going to, you know, this place, and I just want to pick up some packages and do some deliveries? I mean, what's kind of the take there as far as who's driving for your service?
Well, it's hard to tell entirely, like, who is, you know, because if you're working someplace at the airport and your email still, you know, Johan at Gmail, I don't know that you work there and you're taking it on your way or not. But probably 50-50, 60-40 you wind up having of people who want to do it as like a job, and the other parts are on their way doing it. But you're right. I mean, we've seen, you know, with unemployment, it was like one of the only times in history, whether you were like a busboy, a bartender, or a knee surgeon, you were out of work for like a solid 8 weeks, if not still. And it doesn't replace your prior, you know, paycheck, but it does put some money in the place where that once was. And that was helpful to a lot of the drivers. And Roadie was founded on the idea of neighbors helping neighbors, just like my tile story. You know, somebody could help me out and bring that tile there. And the community really, you know, came together. A lot of drivers came onto the platform that helped get the demand that was needed to get stuff out from stores to people. I mean, I did a Walmart gig back in February myself and took it to this lady, and I'm talking to her. I'm saying, well, why do you use it? She goes, oh, I love Roadie. I love the fact that you and Walmart put this out. She goes, because I'm legally blind. I can't get to the store. My father is disabled and lives here, and my husband's only at work. So we literally can't get out. But for ordering groceries from Walmart twice a week and you guys bringing it to us. So Lisa told me that story, and I was like, you know, there's a bunch more Lisas out there that I don't know about, but I know are out there. So we're really helping folks.
Yes. So obviously a lot of these high-tech companies that are in the delivery space, like Uber, Postmates, all of these companies are concentrated in the Bay Area. You're in Atlanta, out of all places. What are some of the advantages or perks of running a startup in a state outside of California, in Georgia? Anything you can share there?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a great university system in the University of Georgia. Georgia Tech is right here in town. So putting out a lot of great people, both in tech and in data science, which are huge for us. Cost of living is obviously less. We've got a number of folks that were West Coast prior and then here. So you can attract talent at more affordable prices and not have the burn you might have if you're on the West Coast. But I've just liked it better. I mean, you know, it's sort of an East Coast sensibility. We've taken a model that's very focused on not just spending a lot of money forever, but really trying to figure out one that at scale, you know, is profitable. And I think we've achieved that. And plus, I think being in the South, you get a little Southern hospitality into your app. I mean, the idea of neighbors helping neighbors and people helping people, you know, it was part of the North Star as we developed, and it's still in there. You just hear wonderful stories. I mean, I told you mine about Lisa, of people like delivering a microwave from Home Depot to an older, you know, think about your grandmother and her not knowing how to unhook it or get it out of the box, and them lifting it up and doing it for her. Just people being good to one another.
Right, right. Obviously, on the technology front, there's a lot we can discuss here. But there's another company that's doing like grocery delivery in Texas and California named Nuro, and they have an autonomous vehicle kind of doing these grocery deliveries for Kroger and some other companies. How do you expect Roadie to kind of leverage the future of transportation, which is kind of concentrated on autonomous vehicles, machine learning, AI? Do you have any plans to kind of expand in that space and leverage some of that technology and kind of integrate it into your existing network?
Yeah, we're totally watching it, but it will be interesting to see how it develops. But to an extent, I don't really care who's pushing the gas. It could be autonomous or it could be somebody. If there is a system in place that provides reliable service to deliver things in neighborhoods or whatever, Roadie can hook into it. That's fine. You've just got to be careful to understand it's still got a ways to go in terms of, you know, you can get something the last mile, but you still got to get it the last 10 feet up to the porch. You still might have to get through a fence. There's a lot of real life things that our drivers deal with. And I talk to them, and those kind of things sometimes can be hard. The other thing you have to consider on autonomous, I mean, it still costs a lot to manufacture these things, and it still depends pretty heavily on human supervision and maintenance. And at the end of the day, a truck is still a truck. So I think these things will be a big part of our future. I think it might be a little further away than most people breathlessly talk about. But Roadie is a solution that works today. And as new technologies and cheaper or more sensible ways of getting stuff there is, there's no reason we can't, you know, hook into any of these systems and allow them to take packages on the Roadie network.
Right, right. So what are some upcoming challenges or things you kind of see in the future that might keep you up at night in this space? Any thoughts there?
Sure. Well, I mean, been asked since day one, like, you know, what do you think about? Maintaining deliverability is huge. When you work in a two-sided marketplace, there's this constant balance of supply and demand and between the drivers and deliveries. But when you're doing it at this scale, I mean, you're needing to figure it out in every community, big and small, at every time of day, in every weather condition, and making sure you've got enough drivers there. And it's just gotten more complex over time. Now, our metrics and on-time delivery rates are up. It's something we've always got to watch because it might be different in Chattanooga, Tennessee than in San Francisco. Or certain things might be the same. I mean, we're also seeing, you know, some entry into the field of some platforms that are trying to get in there to get a bunch of providers on there. And usually it winds up commoditizing some of the services. We found up our relationships with bigger customers when it's one-on-one. You know, you wind up carrying out their brand a little bit better, worse, and maintaining complete control of it, which is different if, you know, it's just going to the lowest cost bidder every time. So I think that's something that's popped up, but it hasn't been a big deal for us.
Yeah, wow. Obviously, I'm sure you're aware that the post office has been having some issues there with logistics and some of their funding. Do you see yourselves kind of positioning yourselves as an alternative to some of these systems like UPS, FedEx, and the Postal Service? Is that the ultimate vision for Roadie?
I think Roadie can work right along beside them. I mean, UPS is an investor in us, and they've been a great partner. But I mean, I think there are certain things that the existing networks, you know, are just not built for. I think same day delivery is one of them. Being able to, you know, work with, you know, without having the hub and spoke model that you sort of see in the UPS and the FedEx and even the USPS model. So I think what you wind out is getting optionality of a lot of other service options that they're not doing. But if you need to send something in something small in a box across the country, you're still better probably sending it with UPS. I just think there's a lot of things that we're winding up doing pretty well and could probably own that space.
Well, perfect. Well, if people want to learn more about Roadie, I'm assuming it's roadie.com, right?
It is roadie.com. If you want to download the app, you can go in the App Store and Google Play and download Roadie Driver and become a driver in about 7 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Well, thanks so much, Mark, for joining us, and I hope to speak again with you soon.
John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, everybody. I just want to let you know that this episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by our friends at the Ford Motor Company, built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress from connectivity to autonomy. Ford has one simple goal, and that's to improve the mobility of its customers. Ford has been using technology to shape the future of transportation for over 100 years and is dedicated to solving the world's most pressing mobility issues. What you might not know is that Ford has a series of divisions that make these visions a reality. Ford X is Ford's venture incubator that unites entrepreneurs, designers, and engineers to shape the future of transportation. Ford's City Innovations team brings innovative ideas to life through community workshops, crowdsourcing initiatives, and citywide mobility challenges. And Spin, a property of Ford, brings e-scooter sharing to cities and college campuses. So here's your call to action. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com. Hey, everybody, let me take a moment to thank Fenwick & West. They're one of the world's first and leading law firms dedicated to technology and life sciences. They operate in the fast lane of innovation where ideas often outpace changes in the law. That's where you find Fenwick's autonomous transportation and shared mobility practice, steering startups, technology giants, and major automotive companies through rapidly evolving legal, business, and regulatory challenges, which we talk about here on Inside Transportation all the time. A Silicon Valley original, Fenwick is a national law firm with offices in Mountain View, San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Santa Monica, and even Shanghai. So here's your call to action. Learn more about how Fenwick can help companies tackle the complex legal and business issues of autonomous transportation at fenwick.com. That's F-E-N-W-I-C-K.com. Thanks again to Fenwick for providing great legal services to me. I use them personally for our investments and for supporting independent media like Inside Transportation. Let's get back to this amazing episode.
Today on Inside Transportation, we have Jerry Tierney, the Mobility Lab Director at Perkins & Will, a global design firm. With over 10 years in the space, Jerry has many insights into the world of transportation, and here he is to share some of his insights with us. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about yourself for our listeners who are meeting you for the first time. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, Perkins & Will is a design firm. I mean, why is a design firm actively involved in the transportation space?
No, that's a great question. So, yeah, I'm Jerry Tierney. I'm an associate principal. I'm actually the co-director of our mobility lab. I'm a co-director along with my colleague, Tara Curtis, of Nelson Nygaard, who are transportation planners that are also part of Perkins & Will.
What got me started is
that we are involved in a lot of urban design, large master plan projects. Mm-hmm. And these are projects which have build out horizons of, certainly in the Bay Area, 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, you start working on one of these projects and the next thing you grind up against your local Department of Public Works and their street standards and their parking requirements. And you start looking at this thing is going to be coming on stream 20 years from now. And we look at all of the changes in the evolution in mobility and we go like, it's going to be a completely different picture. So we wanted to get an understanding of where is mobility going? Where is urban mobility going? How is it evolving? How is it changing? What do we need to be doing to look at our streets and our public realm and adapt it and make it future-proofed and not be designing like at the end of the 19th century, be designing for the horse and buggy when, you know, right. The internal combustion engine is going down the street. So that's what really got us started in this. And the more we got into it, the more fascinating we saw the developments that were going on all different scales of mobility. And also the attitudes towards city and the public realm and the space and how a single modality, namely the automobile mm-hmm. or the internal combustion engine powered vehicle, has come to dominate the public realm at the expense of virtually all other activities that take place in the public sphere. And so when you look at a city of 150 years ago and you look at the public space, which we refer to as streets, you see all sorts of activities going on out there. I mean, just everything imaginable is going on mm-hmm. out there. And now 150 years later, it's a monoculture. It's like we've killed it with just one modality. And we go like, okay, how sustainable is this in every sense of the word, not only just from an energy point of view, but from a social point of view. And the more we looked at it, we felt that this was unsustainable. It was not right. It was not equitable. It was not healthful. On so many levels, it was wrong. And it was time to ask basic fundamental questions. And so that's kind of where we're coming at it from.
And it is kind of interesting because I have heard over the years, it's either like a local state government or I don't think there's anything nationally. I mean, you could kind of explain to us, but when these developments come up, right? Whether it's like a high-rise office building, whether it's a high-rise residential building, there's a certain requirement in some cities or in some states to have a certain percentage of parking spaces or a certain number of parking spaces, certain number of parking spaces available for these developments. I mean, I guess with the onset of micromobility and public transportation systems kind of improving over the past few years, I mean, have you seen any local and state governments kind of relook at those laws and be like, hey, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't require every one of these buildings to have 300, 400, 500 parking spaces, right? And how that's kind of being reused. Any thoughts there?
No, absolutely. Well, we're seeing it here in California, and we're seeing it not only in San Francisco and downtown San Francisco, but we're also looking at the new general plan for Los Angeles. They're planning guidelines. They're working on them right now. But starting with San Francisco and downtown San Francisco and what we call the C3, that's the commercial, that's the zoning district that really is downtown San Francisco, where they have given up parking minimums. So what you were describing before is a parking minimum, that every apartment unit is required to have at least one space or one and a half spaces or two spaces. Or,
and I'm sure that's the biggest challenge, right, for developers of apartment buildings, is that they have to find some way to accommodate all these spaces, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, we used to say that parking defines function and form, you know. In other words, the size of a development was like how much parking could you put on that site, or could you economically build. Mm-hmm. But what happened in San Francisco is that they wanted to go to a transit first policy and moving away from relying on the private automobile. And in areas that were well served by transit, like the downtown, and plus you're totally able to walk to work, mm-hmm. then what if they put in parking maximums? So rather than having a parking minimum, you shall provide a minimum of 1.5 parking spaces per unit. They said you will have a parking maximum of one space for every four units, in other words, 0.25 space per unit. And under a conditional use permit, we were willing to increase that. Now we let you build, say, one space for two units or a half a space per unit. And so what happened was, you know, obviously the lenders, you know, freaked out, and they said, oh, this is like, we won't be able to sell these units and nobody will buy a unit with no parking. Oh, and just let me add that additionally, the San Francisco Planning Department requires that when you buy a unit, you have to buy the parking separately. So it was unbundled.
Oh,
so let's say I'm buying and I'm going to throw out an entirely hypothetical number here. Let's say you're buying a unit for $750,000. Which probably wouldn't buy you a tent in San Francisco right now. But right now,
well, we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of people moving out of the city, so we'll see about that. But
no
anyway,
kidding.
Continue.
But it meant that you might be paying, say, $100,000 for your parking space, and you go like, "Hang on a second, you know, $100,000 for a parking space? I mean, how many Uber and Lyft rides can I get for $100,000?
Right.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
all of a sudden, you start externalizing the cost of owning an automobile. So once you start externalizing the cost of owning this automobile, let's say it's $100,000 for your parking space. Let's say that the average cost of maintaining a car in North America is $9,000. You're spending an awful lot of money on an investment that you're going to get rid of in 3 years' time or 4 years' time. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So anyway, to make a long story short, they built these units. They built them at 0.5 space per unit. Anecdotally, we have found out that they haven't even been able to sell all of the spaces to match up all the units, so that they're having to rent out some of the spaces to nearby office workers. So when people are kind of have the cost of owning an automobile and storing it downtown, when they can walk to work and they can rent a car, they can take an Uber and a Lyft, all of a sudden you find you can live without owning a car. And that's part of what we're getting at, not having to own a car, because owning a car means that if you only utilize that car 4% of the time, and remember, statistically in North America, the utilization of a private automobile is 4%, 4% used, 96% of the time it's stored. Why should I be investing so much in storing this thing that's twice the size of a refrigerator? It just doesn't make sense. You know?
I mean, it is kind of interesting, because I have seen in recent weeks, I guess recent months as well, that car sales have actually not, like, they haven't cratered as most people thought about. And one of the theories is that we've been seeing a lot of people moving out of the city into more suburban areas like Lake Tahoe, where you kind of need a car to get around. I mean, have any of your figures, or have you kind of noticed that trend kind of happen in the past few months as well?
Yeah, we have. Now, there's several things going on here. So we have, first of all, there's been a consistent and overall trend for a certain segment of the population to be feeling comfortable in moving into downtown areas. Mm. We think that trend is going to continue. However, that's not to say that suburbia is going to go away. But we think, though, that suburbia or, say, cities or towns that are relatively close to a major metropolitan downtown are going to change. We see people leaving, say, San Francisco for Tahoe. We see things like this happening, number one, because the cost had become completely unsustainable in San Francisco. But we also see it that because of this COVID-19 and working remotely, mm-hmm. why be paying $2,000-$3,000 a month to get on a Zoom meeting with a colleague who's like a block and a half down the road when I could move to somewhere really attractive, for instance, Lake Tahoe, and let's hope you have great internet service up there, and I can be still on the same Zoom meeting, but I can be on the same Zoom meeting and paying kind of $1,500 a month or $1,000 a month. You know, so in other words, our location is with the COVID-19, some people, and remember, it's not all, but some people are lucky enough to be able to work remotely. And that right. is having an impact on the workplace, and it's impacting our commute patterns. It's impacting transit. It's impacting the freeways and all the roads leading into a metropolitan area. So, you know, this is a great beta test of working from home. And, you know, prior to this, about 4 to 6% of the working population worked from home and felt comfortable working from home, but mm-hmm. always feeling that like they were being left on the outside. But now it's that it is socially acceptable and your boss is working from home and all of the other people in the C-suite are all working from home. It doesn't quite carry that like I'm on the outside track. So that is going to fundamentally change the workplace. And in that change, there will be impacts on transportation and transit.
Yeah, and it is kind of interesting because I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw these photos of like LA just completely without cars. I mean, traffic is down exponentially in so many major cities. What are some other things or observations that you've taken out of this pandemic? And what kind of temporary transportation shifts that are happening right now do you think are going to be made permanent in the long run?
Well, I think it wasn't so much just the photographs of empty freeways in Los Angeles, but it's when Los Angelinos looked vertical and said, "What is all that blue above my head?" You know, they said, "Yeah, the sky is blue," and you know would tell them, and mothers would tell their children, "Yes, the sky is blue. Who knew?" So I'm only kind of joking, but you know what I'm saying is that like, are people willing to go back to the same kind of like yellow green smog of the days of yore? I don't think they are. Are people willing to kind of get into, you know, 5-6 lanes of traffic, getting stuck in one, going in one direction on the Harbor Freeway or the, you know, the 10 or something like that to Santa Monica? I'm not so sure if they are. So I think with the post-COVID, there are some people are going to be able to work remotely. In some of our clients are asking us to look at the impacts of remote working scenarios that are being thrown around. And again, this is not any empirical data, but just people kind of rule of thumb, how they feel in terms of how many employees will choose to work from home at any given time. Numbers like, I say, 1/3 of the workforce working remotely, 2/3 working at an office seems to be a number that's a lot of people are coming down and agreeing.
Wow.
As a working hypothesis makes sense. That up at any given time.
Do you think that's
going to
be the case though? I mean, it seems so radical to have 1/3 of our workforce work remotely. I mean, what's kind of your take there?
It's great. I mean, like let's kind of think this out, because it's not that they're going to be working remotely as in I'm going to be, you know, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, working remotely. What it allow me to do, though, is I can work Monday and Friday, maybe from home, but like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm in the office. It may be
so it's
that
sort of like
I,
a hybrid kind of program.
Exactly, a hybrid. Yeah. And that's kind of what we're looking at. And so, you know, or it may well be that I get up in the morning, I make myself coffee and breakfast, and I do all my email and all those daily chores that we have to do. And then at 10 o'clock, I can go into the city, and now I'm not joining the throngs on congested transit, and I'm able to go in, have my meetings at work, socialize, meet with people, have face-to-face collaboration, and I'm done with that, I've finished my meetings, and now it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I can head on home ahead of the big rush, and then I can carry on working from home. So it's allowing people to kind of have a more flexible work day or work week. And that again, what that the potential there is that where we see transit and traffic operating with an AM and a PM spike, the potential, and I stress this is the potential, exists for leveling out those spikes so we get a more even flow. And of course, that's what all transportation planners and road engineers dream of, is rather than designing for these peaks, it's something that's a bit more uniform and level across the day. And I think that we can get some way towards that. And I think that combined with various incentives will kind of just get a more graduated rather than a kind of a peaky AM and PM spiky kind of a transportation pattern. We'll get something that's more like a regular sine wave, a little bit flatter as well. Having said that, though, we cannot forget that there's a large percentage of the population who do not have the luxury of working remotely. They have to go to work. And we have to make sure that we have a transit system and a mobility system in place that works for them. We cannot be designing it around people who have the luxury of working from home. We have to remember that we want to design a system that's equitable. And, you know, if nothing else, what the COVID-19 has shown us, and there's lessons coming out of this, when we use the term essential worker, who are those essential workers? And all of a sudden, we're lauding essential workers and they're getting on the cover of Time or Newsweek and magazines and everybody's applauding them. I only kind of wish that maybe, you know, you kind of like their pay scale might be reflecting their essential status.
Agreed,
yeah. It seems to me the people that like have the highest income are all the people working from home. Does that make you non-essential? You know, because if folks like this are that essential, I wish you'd pay them that way. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that for a lot of people who are, quote unquote, essential workers, they rely on public transit and they rely on reliable and safe public transit. And we have got to make sure that that is always there.
So one thing I want to ask you about is Uber and Lyft. What's your take on that? Because I actually read a little bit of a piece you wrote that we're actually going to put in the show notes about how Uber and Lyft can kind of make transportation more equitable. Because I totally agree with you. I think, you know, you see so many essential workers that are, you know, working at the grocery stores. Maybe they're working as custodians at the local hospital. But most of them are taking public transportation. And, you know, when the onset of the pandemic was happening, the first thing that transit planners, you know, were doing was just cutting service, right? And it kind of came down to figuring out, okay, when do we cut service? Do we cut service during a peak? Do we cut service, you know, when nobody's really riding at the beginning of the day or the end of the day? And the conversation I was kind of reading about was, well, we're not really acknowledging that public transportation is a lifeline for so many people, right? And even if you're cutting, you know, a 5:30 a.m. bus that maybe has two people. I mean, those are two people that aren't going to have access to their jobs, right?
Yeah.
So what's your take as far as using ride-hailing services or some of that infrastructure that we already have there to kind of make transportation more equal?
That is a great question. And I am in the process of answering this if I take a little bit of a detour, because it really comes down to the question of what do we mean by transit? I mean, what do you mean by transit? We throw this word out, transit, and what pops into everybody's mind? You know, it's kind of the ratty city bus that turns up every 20 minutes or 30 minutes, you know, with a couple of dozen people on board, or, you know, a subway system or something like that. And that's kind of like what pops into people's mind. And I think that we also need, not only do we need to redefine the word transit and what we mean by transit, but also the role of transit in a city, that if it's that essential, I mean, to me, you look at all of the successful, economically and socially successful cities in the world, the one common denominator, besides having adequate water and sewers and reliable power and utilities, is they have got a very reliable and extensive transit system. In other words, an alternative to owning a car. That if I go to Hong Kong, if I go to Beijing, if I go to Singapore, if I go to Paris, if I go to London, if I go to Berlin, if I go to New York, You know, they all have that. And places like LA survive on it in spite of it. So mm-hmm. I think we have to look at transit as being number one. I would consider it as an essential service of a city. It needs to be a utility. And it's a utility that must be available to all and serve the populations that it needs to serve. So if you have a bus line at 5:30 in the morning serving two essential workers, that's a requirement for the successful operation of that city. It's not sort of like, is this something that can be cut? And I would use as a really great example is what the new director of SFMTA, Jeff Tumlin, a former colleague of mine, the SFMTA's reaction to the COVID-19 was inspired. SFMTA runs Muni. They're the transit operator.
Right. In San Francisco. And so, they also run, I think they also run the scooter sharing pilots and a lot of that.
They may well do, but let's focus on the bus and the light rail for now. What they did was they realized that they had to maintain key critical routes, and they chose those routes based on where were the ridership going from communities where the essential service workers lived to where they worked, be that in hospitals, be that in warehouses, be that whatever it is where those people need to work. Mm-hmm. They then basically reduced their entire bus system to serve those routes. They closed down the light rail because they took those workers off to maintaining the buses, because they were now going to have to run buses more frequently with fewer people. And so they completely adapted their entire network to serve essential workers and people who just, you know, the only way they could get to work, your two people you mentioned at 5:30 a.m. In other words, people who relied on transit. And it really was eye-opening, because that is the backbone of transit. So now we've kind of shrunk this system down to this essential service. So what happens to all the rest of it? The people that used to have a bus route, but now it's been canceled. Well, rather than this zero-sum game of looking at TNCs or Uber and Lyft as sort of the enemy of transit, maybe we all need to be a bit grown up about this. And the grown upness has to happen on both the TNC or the Uber and Lyft side, as well as on the transit side. You know, the rancher and the farmer need to be friends. I mean, this is a bit like Oklahoma now. So, you know, I think it's time they have to realize that they have to work together. And I think there are prototype or examples out there. And I have used the example of what the city of Monrovia in L.A. did with the Go Monrovia program, working with Lyft. Or I use the example of Go Dublin, where this is a suburb of San Francisco in the East Bay, where the Livermore Valley Transit Agency used Ubers and Lyfts to augment their rather scattered and underutilized bus service in these low density. In other words, where we have low density ridership and we have 40-seater buses meandering around once every 30 minutes with like mm-hmm. two paying customers on board, just does not make any sense. Take those buses, put them on the capacity lines so that you have a bus every 5 or 10 minutes coming along frequent enough that people know that they don't have to look at the timetable. They know a bus is coming along. And then use the Ubers and the Lyfts to backfill, but don't let them just kind of invite Uber and Lyft come in. They have got to work underneath. In the case of Monrovia, they were a subcontractor to the city of Monrovia. In the case of Go Dublin, they are a subcontractor to Livermore Valley Transit. They set the cost. In other words, that for the customer using that vehicle, it's essentially the same as the bus fare. So right. If in Monrovia, it was a $3 fare, then the ride on Lyft was $3. Now, the fact of the matter is, every bus ride is subsidized, but so is every Lyft ride. So it's a question of like, where are those subsidies coming from? You know, but I think what it is, it's a platform that allows for a more nuanced version of transit. And so that's where I'm ultimately coming back, that when we talk about transit, we should be talking about the buses, we should be talking about the rail, the light rail, we should be talking about the TNCs, the Ubers and the Lyfts, we should be talking about the bikes and the scooters, and in fact, we should be also talking about the sidewalks, because the sidewalks carry more people than anybody, and in fact, the best form of transit are your own two legs walking to and from, you know? So when we started,
it's the most affordable option too.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and if you look at all of those as being part of a transit ecology, we need to look at that transit ecology and come up with a transit ecology that's appropriate for the individual city or town or whatever it is right there. If you're getting noises in the background, I'm going to close my window here. There's somebody has opened up a leaf blower or a log chipper.
No worries. I don't hear anything, but I will say it is kind of promising, though, how you've seen Uber, you know, acquire some companies that are related in the, you know, public transportation space, or they have more willingness to work with public transportation companies. I think there are a few companies they partnered with. I know they acquired like Autocar, which is a company in the UK, and they kind of facilitate some public transport stuff there. So it is kind of interesting. One thing I do want to ask you, though, is how do you think autonomy kind of comes into all of this? I guess the more specifically is with this pandemic, right? Do you think it has advanced the onset of autonomous vehicles? Do you think it's hurt the onset? What's kind of your take on autonomy and what we have yet to see with autonomy? I'm sure you have a lot to say, so feel free.
It's so funny because, you know, autonomy was a bit like, for a lot of people, it was kind of like the shiny object. And now COVID-19 comes in and it's the shiny object, so they all go chasing after COVID-19. I actually think COVID-19 has been very good for autonomy because autonomous vehicles are an incredibly difficult piece of work to develop.
As I know we've seen. 2020 was supposed to be the year.
2020 was supposed to be the year, but when I, you know, our office is in San Francisco. We're about 2.5 blocks from where Cruise is located. Cruise is running at any given time about 100 vehicles throughout San Francisco in autonomous mode. So, I mean, I see them several times a day, and I can always tell when they're in autonomous mode. The reason is because they're the only person that are obeying the rules of the road. They're actually going at the speed limit. They actually make safe lane changes. They actually come to a full stop at a stop sign. They actually go around corners in a consistent arc. And they aren't speeding up and slowing down. They have this kind of rather uncanny floating-like feel when they go through traffic. And you suddenly realize all the other vehicles are all speeding up, slowing down, in a very herky-jerky kind of motion. But what it's done is it's allowing the AV community to continue developing their product, okay? And they are still doing that. But I also think that we have been kind of thinking of the AV as the autonomous car, whereas I think really you're going to see autonomy coming into play in two key areas. One would be in trucking. And already the trucking industry is highly invested in this, is getting more and more so, where you've got long-haul trucking and with platooning and things like that, and variations on that, where you have a shortage of drivers, and there is a shortage of long-haul drivers, and how that can be addressed. And, you know, already California, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming have all passed legislation allowing for autonomous trucks to drive on the road, admittedly in test configuration right now, but nonetheless, they are out there. The other area you're going to see is in maybe bus rapid transit, because one of the largest investments that a transit agency has to make is within their staff, within their operators. And by the pay conditions and pension plans and everything else, you know, that is a very large investment that a transit agency has to cover. I'm not saying that bus operators shouldn't be paid well. I'm all for it. But what I am saying is that maybe a bus operator is sitting remotely supervising 6, 7, 8 buses that are all on a kind of like a BRT kind of guideway. And if you could then take that money and provide vehicles so that they're arriving at your stop every minute and a half, every 2 minutes, it would transform the way we look at buses. In other words, we could go with smaller buses more frequently, you know, operating in a remote, in an autonomous configuration. And you already see places like Jacksonville in Florida working with Beep. Beep is a company that works with Navia They've been working also with the Mayo Clinic. You might have seen some things there.
Oh yes, I've seen that. I've seen that trial in Florida.
So anyway, we have a relationship with Beep, and I think that these are little small steps, and it's interesting that it's happening in places like Jacksonville, Florida. And while in Silicon Valley here we've got Elon Musk, I'm kind of more heartened by what's going on in places like Jacksonville, Florida, and other locations where transit agencies are looking at autonomous vehicles in a BRT configuration, or also on a campus kind of a configuration, or linking, say, a business park to a metro stop. In other words, looking at in LA, we're looking at this. We're also looking at it here in the East Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area, where you have a large office park, and then you have a large arterial road that will go to a BART station, say a mile and a half away. Well, that arterial road could be striped off in such a way that those shuttles could operate, in their own lanes. And once they get into the campus, they're on private property. But this way now, office workers don't have to drive to these places, but they could take transit. So I think autonomy is not going to be the Jetsons, or we're all going to be kind of getting into our own little autonomous cars, maybe for the next 10 years or so. But I do think that you're going to see it in the trucking industry, you're going to see it in transit, and you're already seeing it, obviously, in mining and in agriculture. The mining industry.
That's true, yes.
Heavily invested, as is actually agriculture as well. So ironically, it's in cutting edge places like mining and agriculture that are leading the way, and you'll see it kind of going out from there. So autonomy is carrying on. It's doing its thing. The hubris has died down, thanks be to God. And they're getting into the real world. And to me, the biggest, I hope Tesla isn't a sponsor of your program, because sometimes I think that Elon Musk is the biggest obstacle to, or potential obstacle to, autonomous vehicles, because a Tesla is barely a level 3 autonomy, not even. I have met intelligent people at conferences who say they own a Tesla, and they will swear on a stack of Bibles that that is an autonomous vehicle. It is not. And we should not be advertising that. And all it takes is a couple of more Tesla accidents, and this will really put back research into autonomous vehicles.
You don't think they're going to have a full self-driving, automated driving suite by the end of the year, as he has said, Elon?
Is it on Earth? You'll have it in space. You'll have it on Mars.
You do have an interesting point. I mean, I guess when you do use terms like autopilot and you say this is a full self-driving, driving like software, it is still a little bit far from level 5. I mean, I personally don't think we're going to see a level 4 car. Like, my personal thoughts is, it's going to take like 10 years, maybe, based on what I've seen. But based on what you've seen, how long do you think it's going to take to get to level 4?
I think it's going to be the location. It's like in real estate, it'll be location, location, location. I think you will see level 4 probably quicker than that. If there's a market case for it, I think you will. I mean, the reason why we see it in agriculture and mining is for the simple reason there is a very strong market case for that, just cutting down on labor costs, mm-hmm. Then it's only a matter of time before that same kind of rubric is applied to, transit, to buses, or it's certainly a vehicle that's going along a fixed route, down from a train station to an office park and back on a big wide boulevard. Somebody will be able to find that, an autonomous version of this bus could work perfectly well on this instead of paying for an operator. That operator could be supervising, as I said, half a dozen buses. I think there's going to be a strong market case for that, because you've got to remember, like, the impacts of COVID-19 on transit have been massive, and because it's part of the way we fund them. And this is kind of goes back to an earlier comment I mentioned about transit being a utility, that if we see transit as an essential service and essentially a utility, we should fund it accordingly. We no more ask our sewer system or our water system to earn a profit than why should we be doing the same for a transit system? And when you flush the toilet, you don't say, gee, did that flush now earn money for somebody? You know, it's, you know, we
it
should.
It is kind of interesting because we're seeing a very similar thing with the post office right now. Why do you think that government agencies, specifically on the local level, always see public transportation as something that isn't a utility? Is it because of the type of people that are writing the systems?
Yeah, it's the way that we have always thought of it as something aside. I mean, historically, transit systems are a little over 100 years old, 120 years old maybe, and they were started up by and large by private companies and then were gradually municipalized in many instances. So they kind of started as a private model. But of course, so did most of the electric companies and the water companies. But because like an electric company here in Bay Area, we have Pacific Gas and Electric. Okay, that's essentially, you could say, a private company, but it's a privately regulated company. So what you may see is that, you know, again, applying the PUC rules, that's the Public Utilities Commission rules, we kind of take these private companies in and we make them work for the good of the larger public, and there's going to be fixed rates. And they are given a kind of a monopoly, you know, because we're going to fix your rates, we will give you somewhat of a monopoly in here. So that's kind of how that business model works. I mean, maybe with transit, we kind of have to look at the same kind of a thing. We can't be having transit rely on just the fare box. Mm-hmm. That's insane. It's just not going to happen. And so recognizing that it is an essential service, successful cities enable people to move around without the use of a private car, because if everybody got into a private car, it'd be like L.A. at rush hour. And you've got to remember, L.A. is probably the city with the highest investment in public transit right now. You know, for a lot of really, really exciting experiments going on in transit. Look at what Salida Reynolds is doing down in L.A. Tremendous work. They're exploring all of the options for the simple reason that there are very few cities on the planet that have tried to build their way, build freeways to address everything. And even still, they're congested. So they are open to all and every kind of suggestion. So watch LA as a kind of a place that's doing innovative and exciting things. But, you know, we have to recognize that the funding model for transit is not appropriate for the needs of what that we place on transit. It's almost set up to fail.
And I will say the few times I've seen, you know, local governments attempt to kind of rectify that or you know, they try to kind of wean off subsidies, it just gets worse, right? Because service gets affected, ridership goes down, and then you don't really have any, you haven't really made up for any lost ground, right? Because no. I mean, no. I think that's what I've always seen in the news, is that local governments always just want to cut public transportation, and they want to reallocate some of that funding for roads or for freeways and stuff like that. So I hope, you know, it is improved upon, especially in the U.S., because that's something that we don't really have, is just a very robust culture behind public transportation.
We really don't, because because I think for a lot of people in this country, they've never experienced what a quality transportation system looks like in its full and broadest sense. And one of my favorite examples is actually in Switzerland. You know, having been lucky enough to travel there several times, and going to a place outside of Chur, which is in the southeast of Switzerland, and you fly into Zurich Airport, and very, very pleasant airport. And then about six levels below, there's high-speed rail station. Wow. And I can get on a train at Zurich in the airport and go direct high-speed rail out to Chur. And I get off in Chur, and then waiting for me is another little train that takes me up a meter gauge train that takes me heading up to a place called Wals. And you get to there, and then there's the post bus is waiting for you, and you get on the post bus, and, you know, and it's, what is this, like a little Mercedes van, and it's the post guy, and he's, you know, it's got enough space for, what, six passengers, and you pile in there, and you go further up the mountain. And then on the reverse trip, when I get down to Chur, I can actually check in for my Swiss Air flight and check in my bags, for God's sakes, your boarding pass, all of those type of things at the train station.
Wow.
And, you know, this is kind of like very pleasant, you know, and of course it's entirely efficient and entirely Swiss, but it's fun, you know. But, you know, that is an example of it. And yet when you get to Zurich and you see how efficient the transportation and the trams, and then you find out that Zurich transportation, I believe it has around about 7 different private operators, but they're all franchised under S-Bahn, under the Swedish rail system. So for me as the customer, it's kind of like the McDonald's or the Kentucky Fried Chicken. I don't, you know, I'm not so concerned that that individual store I'm going into is owned by somebody else. All I know is that I'm going into a McDonald's or a Kentucky Fried Chicken. And so it's kind of the branding, and you're franchised. So it can be done. And it's just and it's also seamless. And my ticket is all one ticket all the way through. And everything is waiting when you get off. In other words, when I get off the train in Chur, my meter gauge train is waiting for me. And when I get off in further up the line, my post bus is waiting for me. So in other words, everything is timed to work with everything else. That's what they call a seamless transportation. We don't have that here. We just simply do not. I mean, New York, you've got a density of subway lines with the frequency of trains that it feels seamless, but it's seamless kind of almost in spite of itself. It's a good system. But like if you're in Houston or if you're in, I don't know, I mean, in some other city, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, you just simply don't have, you're not exposed to public transit, let alone quality public transit. And to think that this, you know, is it totally impossible? You've got to realize up until the end of the Second World War, up until 1945, the largest streetcar network in the world was in what city? Los Angeles.
Right. Yeah.
LA. Up until the Second World War, LA had the largest streetcar metro system in the world, for God's sakes. And that's where a lot of the freeways were laid out on the alignments of the old streetcar network. And so, you know, it's not too long ago that a place like L.A., you could get around using a streetcar system. And so it's not like it's completely alien. It's somehow riding transit is, you know, antithetical to the American psyche. That's not the case. It's just we have kind of forgotten about it.
I guess, you know, when you do look at micromobility and car sharing and all these things that are going to be growing in the future, I think it's going to be hand in hand with public transport. I know I have a bunch of friends in LA who have just sold off their cars and they're like, hey, I'm just going to do public transport and go on Lyft. And they seem to be pretty happy. So I think, you know, once we start seeing those improvements in cities like LA, it's going to be a totally different ballgame. It'll be interesting to see also how automakers and companies like Uber and Lyft kind of grow and evolve with the times as well. As I'm sure you're aware, you know, Uber and Lyft are kind of facing this battle in California right now about AB5. And I know that franchise model you were kind of talking about in was it Switzerland that you were mentioning?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they're thinking even about bringing that franchise model to California if they do, you know, impose AB5 on these companies, right?
Yeah, you know, I've got to, first of all, I think that the notion that a lot of the Lyft and Uber drivers are contractors, well, yeah, in the technical sense, but for a lot of folks, you know, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it is a duck. You know, they turned up. These people put in an 8-hour shift and to have no benefits, to no health plan. I'm entirely behind the fact that they need to get those things that every other worker is entitled to and is provided with, hopefully through their employment. So, okay, now what's that going to do to the profitability of Uber and Lyft? I don't know. I mean, does it mean that they're, you know, they weren't making money beforehand, and are they making less money now or whatever?
So during the pandemic, their ride hailing business have actually turned a profit. because it's so low traffic. I mean, obviously, if you look at the business model, the reason why they had been losing so much money was because every time somebody takes a ride on Uber and Lyft, like you were kind of saying, it's subsidized, right? So yeah. Since they've actually been paying out less of those subsidies, they were actually able to turn a profit on the core ride hailing business. But right now, it's mainly the delivery company that's losing money for them, or the delivery side of things.
Really? I didn't know that one. I haven't followed that one close enough over the last couple of years.
But overall, as a company, they are unprofitable. Yeah.
But I do think, though, that that business model, and I think the lesson to be learned from Uber and Lyft is it was remarkable what they came up with. It was quite remarkable because, you know, a taxi, at least in San Francisco, taxis were just so... it was a monopoly. And I mean, hailing one, if they didn't like the look of you, they weren't going to stop. And so there was definitely equity issues coming into play there. And, you know, the population of a city has now been so acclimated to using an Uber and a Lyft that when you go to another city, when you go to an airport, when you go around the world, you bring out your Lyft or Uber app and you get it. I mean, it's completely transformed how we relate to getting around a city. It's remarkable, you know, and that toothpaste ain't going back in the tube, you know. So if Uber and Lyft, if that business model kind of maybe can't make a profit, is there some way we can take that business model and adapt it so it works as part of the transportation ecology? I'm not a businessman. I can't tell you what that model looks like. But all I know is that the business model from the experience of the user or the rider is wildly successful. I feel it's entirely appropriate. And is there a way of now bringing this into the part of the transit ecology that serves a city, along with the bikes, along with scooters, along, as I said, with the sidewalks and walking? You know, we have the Ubers and the Lyfts, and we have transit, and we have light rail, and we have subways, and we have like heavy rail, and we have high speed rail. We need everything in there because the goal here is to make a world where not owning a car is a viable option. I mean, that's what we're getting at. I mean,
yes. Well, where can people learn more about you, Jerry? I mean, this was a very compelling talk. If people want to see more of your insights, where can they follow you? Where can they get in touch?
I'm on LinkedIn, and of course, you know, Perkinson Will. If you go to Perkinson Will and our mobility lab in there, I wish I could, Perkins, you know, Perkins, Will, Will. And just Google me and it should take you into, the mobility lab. And, you know, we're always working away on stuff. Hardest part is just keeping the website up to date.
Yeah, we'll drop some links in the show notes for all of you. This was a fascinating conversation. I feel like we could have been talking for another 2 hours, but thank you so much for joining me today. And I hope you can visit us again soon.
Absolutely. And thank you for inviting me.
All right. And that was my sit down with Jerry Tierney from Perkins and Will. Thanks to the Perkins and Will team for putting that together. Jerry's super knowledgeable, and I'm glad I had him as a guest. And a big thank you to all our loyal subscribers for listening to this podcast. This has been a journey. It's been a lot of fun. We've gotten to speak with a lot of interesting people. And we hope we're going to just continue rolling with gas topics. What do you want to hear? JoeHuntInsight.com. Let me know. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next week. Take care.